for we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it. But let each one take heed how he builds on it, for no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if anyone builds on this foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each one's work will become clear, for the day will declare it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test each one's work of what sort that it is. 1 Corinthians 3, 9-13. The religious environment of today is filled with individuals and groups building upon the foundation laid 2,000 years ago, some with gold, others with straw. Still others have chosen to attempt to relay that foundation. Join us on the first Sunday of the month as we find those who are building and examine just what it is that they are building. Good evening, everybody. We are back together once again. We're recording this one a little bit late after the last one got out late, but we're here. We're here to chat, and we've got some interesting stuff to talk about tonight. What do you think, Matt?
Well, yes. This group we're going to discuss, I heard about many years ago. I read a blog post about them. It predates both of us by a little while.
A little bit.
But it is, once again, from not too far from our neck of the woods, a group based in Arkansas.
Yep.
Although there are some conflicting accounts of whether it was Arkansas or Missouri.
Well, they were right on the line. Like, their property touched the line. They were on the Arkansas side, but it touched the line, so they spent a lot of time on the other side as well.
And some of their advertisements said Missouri.
Right. Yeah, it's a matter of where you get the most benefit. So
you want to tell everybody the name of this group?
Yeah, so we're talking about the Covenant, the Sword, the Arm of the Lord tonight. They were founded in the mid-70s by a man named James Ellison. They were originally founded as Zarephath Community Church up there near Mountain Home, Arkansas. Just as a group of people living together in the woods, loving life in an old abandoned resort village. It's where they hung out.
Well, let's talk about Mountain Home a little bit. Now, our listeners may not know, Mountain Home up there is in the very north part of Arkansas, right? We're talking about right there by Missouri?
Yep.
That is the legend of the hillbillies. If y'all were to discuss the Beverly Hillbillies, you know, that's a fictional thing, but they would have come from an area very similar to this in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. This is the definition of hillbillies. So we've got is it a mountain range up there? Yes, the Ozarks, right?
Yep, we got the Ozarks.
And they're not super high mountains. They're actually quite old mountains. The reason I mention this is they're quite old mountains, but they are mountains, but they're not, say, the Rockies and not even quite the Appalachians, right?
Yeah.
It's probably one of the more minor ranges in the United States. They're also full of caves and lots of wildlife up there.
Yep. Now, we weren't planning to talk about this, but since you mentioned the caves, I must tell you, you'll find this really interesting. When I was preaching for a boys' camp there in Ponca, just even further west from Mountain Home, we decided that we were going to go do some hiking and found the old Bat Cave, right? It was an old cave that was always full of bats, and we decided that day that I was going to preach in the Bat Cave. So we crawled, you know, 50, 60, 75 feet off into the mountain, and it is pitch black. There is no light whatsoever. And so I'm standing there with a flashlight and preaching to all these boys who are just sitting there in the dark, and they can just see me. That's it. That's all that it was. It was absolutely awesome.
Adventures of a Young Youth Pastor.
Yes, Absolutely. It's always fun when you can do something crazy like that.
I miss the whole youth pastor thing and being able to do fun things like that, you know? You rarely get criticism from your youth.
Right.
Your parents, maybe. I don't know. You probably didn't get as much criticism as I did, but you really get criticism from youth. You know, you want to offer up something crazy. Let's do it. They're all for it. What did you preach on?
I don't remember. It was probably, if I had to guess, knowing me at the time, it would have been on Jesus as the light of the world, since we were sitting in pitch darkness. Most likely, probably something along that lines.
Did you do a little singing?
No.
Jesus is just okay with me.
No singing on my part. I avoid that one.
Yeah, I was never gifted with that. But thankfully, as Baptist, gifted does not necessarily exclude you from singing. It just means sing a little louder.
Right.
But yes, we are getting off a little bit. So you spent some time in the mountains, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So my grandmother used to live up north that way. Mm-hmm. Not quite as far north as this, but up into the Ozarks. And we spent a little time as kids, you know, running around in the mountains, finding caves. Remember this beautiful waterfall was on her property? She had 40 acres up there. And they had this waterfall way up in the back of the property.
Yep.
That was really cool. I remember my uncle telling us stories about hunting. Something about he had he only had one shotgun shell, and the family was hungry, and he went out there, and he shot the shotgun shell at the birds, and he fell off the thing, and on the way down, he hit a deer, he killed the deer, landed in the water, popped up out of the water with a fish in each pocket. He got himself two birds, a deer, and two fish.
Yeah, so
I'm not sure my uncle told the truth all the time.
I was going to say, so you were mentioning the hillbilly story. It sounds a lot like one of them hillbilly stories. But the whole point of this, right, really, you know, we talk about it being off topic, but it's really not, right? Because Carrie Noble, whose autobiography or something, whatever you want to call it, I don't know what you would call it of his, his description of the CSA at the time, you know, he spends the first chapter talking about, you know, how he and his wife came to Mountain Home to Zarephath Community Church for the first time, and they were off in a valley somewhere with a river and a creek and a lake, and it was just absolutely stunningly beautiful, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy, right, from the very moment that you walk into that environment to say, I could stay here. I could just be here forever. It's a perfect spot to go if you want to just get away from everything.
So him and his wife went to go visit the Zarephath Community Church.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they go visit?
He and his wife were friends with Tom and someone, I don't remember their name. That were already there, members of the community. So he and Carrie and his wife, Kay, drove up from Dallas, right? They were here in Dallas at the time.
In Bible school, right?
Yeah, yeah. Just to go and visit, right? They just wanted to go and see them. His wife was fixing to have their baby. So they were just like, well, let's go up and see Tom and I don't remember his wife's name. And so they got up there. Now, it was not their intention to go and stay. At least not according to him, right? He writes and he's like, you know, we wanted to go and check on them, be sure they were good, because, believe it or not, Tom and his wife had just previously left the Children of God cult. So, they had left them and wound up here, so, you know, Carrie and his wife went to just be sure it wasn't another cult. You know, make sure our friends are not part of another cult. And they got up there, and they were there for a couple of weeks. Baby was born. And they're just like, you know what? We just want to stay. And so they stayed.
I can't imagine being so carefree to go do something like that. Man. On one hand. On the other hand, we mentioned youth ministry thing earlier. When I became a youth minister, I had went and visited a church that I had previously attended, a church that I was baptized at, that I had left. I'd left and everything, and I went back to this church because they were having a church anniversary, and that's what these small Baptist churches do, right? They had a church anniversary, and all the old members come back, and the family, and, you know, they just, all the people are there. And while I was there, I felt the Holy Spirit moving. And I felt the Holy Spirit tell me I needed to be at that church. So I immediately rejoined up. And I went to the pastor and I said, hey, the Lord says I need to be here. I feel like I'm called to be here and I need to do something. I'm here to work. I'm here to serve. And he's like, well, we'll find a place for you to serve. And that's how I ended up in youth ministry. There's more to that story, but that's the basic synopsis of it. So I get the Spirit working things in your life and listening to such a thing. But I was also in the same town and just changed the church I went to, not moved 6, 7, 8 hours away. And my wife just had a baby and all that stuff. So it seems like a big jump.
That's 6, 7, 8 hours today. In the 70s, it would have been like 16.
Well, that's a good point.
Because 71 wasn't what it is now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yep. There would have been no flying or nothing. It would have been just...
Nope, not into that area.
Yeah.
That's a long drive.
But that's what I'm saying. It's a big change to go up there and do that. So I find it like, wow, they did such a thing. So they obviously seen something there. I'm trying to stick to our history and not go into the beliefs, but part of the reason they moved was because of their beliefs, which we'll cover in a little bit.
Yep. Yep. So while they were there, this was, I think, 76, maybe 77 when Carrie and his wife got up there. It wasn't too long after that, that the group changed their name. Sometime late 77, early 78, they changed their name from Zarephath Community Church to Zarephath Horeb Community Church. Because of changes that were going on, right? The church or the community had just bought some land from Campus Crusades, right? Campus Crusaders for Christ or whatever it was called at the time. They bought... It's like 219 acres, or yeah, you know, it was quite a bit. It was a good bit of land up there.
And sure it was like, hey, you know, we're not going to use this, so we're going to sell this to another Christian organization.
Right.
Yep. It seemed like a good thing.
Uh huh. Yeah. But Ellison, the founder, got up and prophesied in service that, you know, they were in a transition period as a church. As a community. And so in the same way that Elijah transitioned from Zarephath to Mount Horeb, that they too were going to transition. And so their name became Zarephath Horeb. And then some fun stuff started. It's really about the time that things... Transitioned is a perfect word for it. They received some material, some cassette tapes and some pamphlets from David Ebaugh, the summer of 78.
And let's mention that distributing information on cassette tape was a very popular thing at the time.
Yeah, cassettes absolutely.
Were quite popular. Most people had some sort of a cassette player. Religious information, especially distributed via cassettes, was very popular.
Yep. Well,
motivational materials, all those things.
I mean, it's the same thing as podcasts, right? It's just a different medium, right? We're doing the same thing. We're trying to get this information out to the public, right? It just doesn't cost us near as much to do it because we're not having to print thousands of cassette tapes to make it happen.
Well, and we're not trying to start cults. We're trying.
Right. That's true.
I guess warn people about cults and inform people, but not start them. And I don't think this guy was trying to start cults, but he was definitely trying to start a movement of hatred.
I don't think Eba was necessarily pushing towards hatred.
Fear.
Kind of fear was a big thing. Fear was his topic of choice. There's a word that I want to use there, but I can't think of it. He started talking about the future judgments of God, right? On people and on the nations, and saying that those judgments were going to start at the end of the summer.
So we got two different people here who are taking direct communication from God and telling these folks what to do because of the communication they got from God.
Right.
With Ellison and then Ebal here.
Yep. So this...
Now, he didn't actually know these people. They just had these tapes from him, right?
Right.
But they were all listening to him and, hey, Paul, check this out. Hey, Mary, look at this.
They were listening to it and taking it in for absolute prophetic truth. Right.
And I've heard Kerry say that it took him a little bit to believe
it. Yeah, it wasn't an overnight thing. Kerry, really, in the beginning, Kerry was the one, according to his book, right, he was the one teaching all the Bible studies. He was the one teaching and leading these people in these directions. So he was going and he was the one reading and listening to these other ministers and groups. So he was starting to teach it. He was starting to integrate some of the teachings in with his Bible studies, right? And that's kind of how it starts. You teach one small thing here, and it just kind of turns into something more.
Yeah, I find that interesting. We'll talk some more about that.
Yeah.
He was the one who introduced that, according to him.
Mm-hmm.
And not so much James Ellison.
Right.
But obviously James Ellison was the leader of this group.
Mm-hmm.
Kerry, who we get a lot of information from because he's written a couple books about this.
Yep, and done lots of interviews.
And done lots of interviews. And he's, rejected what he previously taught. We should start off with that.
Right, yeah.
But this whole thing that the world would end at the end of summer, that kind of made them change their priorities a little bit. They were already fairly separationist, right? But this made them really separationist. So we're going to be separated away from other people. But I've heard Kerry say that they started off with, they were going to have a, I don't think he used the word utopia, but a place out there. And they didn't really consider that there might be people who wouldn't want them to have that place. They didn't consider there would be people who might be against them or negative.
Right.
In the beginning, it was more of a almost hippie commune thing. Oh, we're going to live free and we're going to worship the Lord and be together and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, doesn't sound like such a thing. I mean, you and I have talked about Compound more than once.
Right?
I mean, yeah. Really?
I'm trying to remember throughout the book, because he does mention a few times how they hadn't fully thought through everything that they were doing. Right, so in the same way, kind of like what you're saying, is they didn't really think about the fact that some people would be unhappy with them being there. And as this survivalist mentality started to build, they didn't start thinking about people who didn't want them there. More so, they started thinking about the people that would come and rob them.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Right? He said that at the beginning, they didn't think about people might rob them.
Right. Yeah. They that was not a concern because, I mean, they're out in the middle of nowhere.
They were going to welcome people who might come at the end.
Yep.
But then, later that started changing.
Yeah, this idea that the next set of materials that they receive really pushes that direction even further. Late 78, early 79-ish, they received some more material in the same way from John Todd. Now, John Todd claimed, to be the Grand Druid of the Council of 13.
Grand Druid?
Yep.
And what does he say a Grand Druid is?
Kerry didn't describe that, and I didn't go and dig through all of John Todd's stuff. Because he's John Todd, right? But he's the one who really started, really popularized a lot of the conspiracy theories that we still hear today. You know, things like the Illuminati is coming, the New World Order, the Zionist occupied governments, all of those things that, you know, Satan is trying to take over the world through all of these different avenues, the Rothschilds and whatnot.
I mean, I had lunch with the Illuminati folks last week. They didn't pick up the tab, though. All world powerful, new world order. They sure didn't pay for much.
Yeah.
Now, Brian, y'all, Brian's thinking, who did Matt have lunch with?
I don't know. I'm trying to think.
Who is he referencing? Is the Illuminati? Yeah.
I was gonna say, I don't think I had lunch with you last week. But yeah, so he did. He pushed them from this fear of the judgment of God, right? Because this is late in 78, early 79. So the judgments of God didn't happen in the end of the summer as they expected. So now they're picking up these other things and beginning to wonder, well, maybe, right? Maybe this is what the issue is, not necessarily the judgments of God. And so they started to ingrain these things, and Kerry wrote some materials. I tried to read through it, and then I left my book at home last week, so I didn't get to finish. But he wrote pamphlets on the Illuminati and the New World Order and everything that goes along with it. So Kerry was writing these as Zarephath Horeb, right, so that they could produce them and send them out just the same way that John Todd had been. So at some point, they fully accepted these teachings, right? And one of the things that John Todd said, right, was it wasn't enough to have rural housing, food, clothing, but that Christians would need to protect themselves with weapons against the riotous criminals. John Todd said we needed guns. And so from August 1978, so this must have been a little bit earlier in 78, through December 1979, Zarephath Horeb spent $52,000 on weaponry.
Guns were a lot cheaper back then. Nowadays, they get you a couple of ARs and, you know, lots of 9mm or something.
Yeah.
But guns were a lot cheaper back then. You know, I'm pretty pro-gun in general.
Yeah.
I'm not against a person or even a group of people having some guns to defend themselves and things. But I will tell you, there's definitely a fine line of well, there's the thing in the Bible. Remember where, you know what I'm getting to, don't you? Remember where Judas betrayed Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
And they came to arrest Jesus. And I believe it was Peter pulled his sword.
Yep.
Cut off dude's ear. And Jesus told him to put it away. Now, the Bible also says, be prepared to carry your sword with you when you go on a trip. But at that point, he told him to put it away. Because it's not always beneficial for a Christian to use a weapon. Weapons are a tool that can be used for good and evil. I'm not going to go full into gun control here, but I do want to say that I'm generally pro-gun. But when your group goes out and spends all that money on weapons, you have to wonder, what are they really scared of?
Yeah.
And if they got the Lord to protect them, why are they scared?
Yeah. You know, I just want to help make it clear for our listeners. You know, you and I understand how many guns that is, right? Because we've read the FBI files. For the listeners who have not read the FBI files...
That's true. That's a good thing to bring up, because 52,000 is not much guns nowadays, but exactly. Read that.
This is just a portion. This is not the whole page, because I don't have time to read the whole page. One live light anti-tank weapon.
Hold up. Live anti-tank weapon, which we're going to come back to this weapon, by the way, this particular one. Uh-huh. But an anti-tank weapon.
Yeah. Numerous knives with blades of 9 inches or longer. 94 rifles, 30 handguns, approximately 35 machine guns and sawed-off shotguns, and one heavy machine gun, and 2 improvised landmines, 25 destructive devices, aka booby traps, 40 improvised hand grenades, 320 blasting caps, 4,000 feet of detonating cord, 56 of dynamite, 38 kinetic explosives, 3.5 blocks of C4 explosives, safety fuse, military trip flares, smoke grenades, black powder, smokeless powder, and several 100,000 rounds of ammunition.
This is what they had when they were busted.
Yes. Yeah.
Which was in... We're going to get there, but that was in 85, so it was several years later.
Right.
And we're going to find out what happened to the half block of C4.
Yeah. So let's jump, because we're encroaching on our time limit that we've set for talking history, and we're only halfway through history.
But the worst part's fixing to happen.
Right. In 1979, Jim Ellison went away on a trip to Minnesota, if I remember right. And when he returned, he came back with another cassette tape, because... cassette tapes were the devil, from Dan Gaiman. Dan Gaiman was the author of The Two Seeds of Genesis 3:15. I do not suggest you go read that. I might read it on my other podcast, so we can talk about it. But in the book, Gaiman presents that Cain, Adam and Eve's son, Cain, was the literal son of Satan, through the necessary procreation methods, while Abel was the literal son of Adam. More than this, Adam was white. Specifically, Adam was white. Had lots of reasoning behind that. Other races, blacks, Asians, others, etc., are not descended from Adam, but from a pre-Adamic inferior race. The Jews today are of that inferior race, while the Anglo-Saxon white people are part of the 10 lost tribes that migrated north into Europe. Yeah, that's about...
I don't want us to get marked as explicit on Apple, so I'm going to weigh this very carefully. That's a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
There's nothing biblical about it.
Nope.
It's just made up. Reasons to hate people because of the color of their skin. I will tell you one other thing that really stuck to me is this concept that you mentioned there about blacks, Asians, others, basically anybody who isn't white or Aryan, or some sort of inferior race.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed they didn't have a soul.
Right.
And that black people couldn't blush. And... because they didn't blush, that meant they didn't actually have blood in them like that, and so they didn't have a soul. But I will tell you, since I am married to a very beautiful, dark-skinned black woman, she can very much blush. Not that blush is any indication of anything, but not only did this go against all teachings from the Bible, all teachings from Jesus, it went against all common sense and logic right. entirely.
Yep.
And yet, they adopted these teachings because they'd already adopted a culture of fear.
Right.
And a culture of superiority in that they had this land and they had this place and they were written prepared and they were serving God. So when they were told this ridiculous story that the Jewish people of today are not really the Jewish people, not really descended from Abraham, that really all white people are actually descended,
mm-hmm.
they believed it.
Yep.
And you know what? Variations of this story have distorted the Christian message and the message of the covenant to this day. I very recently was talking to somebody who has no ounce of hating somebody because of the color of their skin, but who really thought that, oh yeah, aren't these people, you know, come from the 10 lost tribes? Didn't they come from the 10 lost tribes? But there's no truth in this whatsoever.
No.
So these little pieces get put into our culture, and we have to be careful with this. So I don't want to go over our time, but I just wanted to mention right. the blushing thing because it's ridiculous.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, it flies in the face of all logic, right? If you're unwilling to go and figure it out for yourself, you probably deserve to be laughed at. So
I'll write it.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, if you're just unwilling, then I laugh at you. So shortly after this, right, you know, they took in these teachings and they started to implement this idea of Christian identity, which we'll get into more about Christian identity when we get to the theology.
But that's really the movement they joined by doing right. this.
They changed their name once again, right, to the Covenant, the Sword, the Arm of the Lord in 1981.
Which just happens to have the abbreviation of CSA.
Right.
Confederate States of America.
Oh yeah, see, this is the thing. I kept sitting here thinking, like, what are you talking about?
I see that look on your face. That's why I mentioned it.
And yeah, it's just because
when
that's
they were
not...
busted, and Kerry was not, or Kerry, I don't know if he was out or if he got not arrested today. He did an interview very shortly afterwards, and this was before he rejected mm-hmm. them. He referred to them as the CSA, and he wore a hat, a trucker's cap that said CSA.
Yeah.
On it. This is where they start changing. I'll let you go on about that.
Yep.
About how they're doing things.
This is the big, I say the beginning of the end. Really the beginning of the end was when they took on, the first guy, Ebal. But, they changed their name to Covenant Sword, the Arm of the Lord. And they began to make partnerships, right? They began to join up with other groups, specifically groups that were known to be in the Christian identity movement and white supremacist groups, like the Aryan Nations in Idaho or the Klan, the Christian Patriots Defense League, right, which was big on Christian identity, the Posse Comitatus, etc.
And we should mention that where they were at in the country, there was not a whole lot of black folks as it was.
No.
So even before they adopted this, it would be normal for them to very little come into contact with black folks, especially being yep. up in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it I would say it probably wasn't a huge leap for them from Christian identity to white supremacist. Right? So they made these connections, and in 1982, they held a CSA convention, right? Or I think they specifically called it a convocation, mm-hmm. Where they invited all of these different groups. And they all came to their compound in Mountain Home and had a couple of days of discussions amongst themselves against these minority races. And the Aryan Nations, I think, was probably the first to declare their official statement was a quote-unquote declaration of war against the United States. And they started rolling, robbing armored cars and things like that, and robbing banks. And then some other groups followed suit, and then the CSA followed suit. And the CSA began to get... They went from being, we're going to be defensive and protect ourselves in the event of total collapse of society, to we're going to bring about the total collapse of society. And they got violent. Very, very violent. Very, very quickly.
Very.
I have notes. I don't know if they're... I don't know if the timeline is in order or... No, it's not. Okay. There are several things that they did.
Why were they getting violent? I think that's important to the history. Why did they think they had to be violent?
I think it was for multiple reasons, right? At some points in the history, they were trying to start the race wars, right? So that the whites could come out on top, right? There were other times where they realized, or where they thought, you know, the United States government's run by a bunch of Satanist Jews, and so we want to take them down, right? There are times that they thought, you know, if we'll do this, right, if we start the war, then Jesus will come, right? So it kind of, I think it really shifted, depending on who you were talking to and what specific act of violence they were doing as to why it was going to happen.
But they believed they were serving God by causing violence. Yeah. And again, I have to point out, this is not what Jesus preached.
Nope.
But they're already off the rocker, so they just kind of keep going off the rocker there.
Mm-hmm. So a short list of the things that they did, or attempted to do. they attempted to assassinate U.S. District Judge Waters, who was the judge who had sentenced Wayne Snell, if I remember right. Prosecutor Asa Hutchinson, who is currently the governor of Arkansas. Is he still the governor? Yep.
Currently the governor. He's term limited out in the next election.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I don't know if it was this previous one or the next one. He was the prosecutor who had brought up charges against some of their friends. FBI agent Jack Knox, who was the one who had prosecuted or had investigated their friends. Fortunately, this assassination attempt was foiled when they were driving through the mountains of Mountain Home, Arkansas in the snow and had a car wreck.
So they had this car wreck and they had the car full of guns.
Yeah.
And they had this car wreck. And so when the wreck happened, several of them got out, got the guns, and ran off into the woods.
Yep.
Leaving Carrie and another guy to deal with it. Once again, Carrie's the central figure in this story.
He is.
Maybe because we're reading stories he told.
True.
So he's going to tell things from his perspective, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Things he was involved in, things he was there.
Yep. So I'm going to... hit another attempt. They attempted to blow up the gas main that runs over the Red River just outside of Texarkana. They didn't use enough dynamite, so all it did was put a big old dent in the side of it.
So for our listeners in Texarkana, this is, if you're going on I-30, there at Fulton, if you go past the Cotton Patch? What's the name of that store over there by the gas main?
No, that's the Boll Weevil.
The Boll Weevil. Right, yep. Over there by the Boll Weevil, that big metal pipe that crosses the river right there.
It's a natural gas line.
They tried to blow that up, yeah.
Yep.
They took apparently a half a block of C4, yep, and duct taped to the side of that thing.
Yeah.
It looked like it'd work in the movies.
Right. Now, they did that because that gas main runs from Houston all the way to Chicago, right? And if they had been successful, Chicago would have been without heat and power and whatever else until that was fixed. And that would be a massive deal. Their intention was, we want to start riots in Chicago because they don't have heat.
That's... For any potential terrorists listening now, there are multiple sources going to Chicago now. That is right. Not the only way to do it. That gas maybe is still sitting there unprotected. You could walk up to it and cut it now.
Yep.
But it wouldn't do what you think it would.
I do wonder, did they replace the dented pipe, or is the dent still there?
I don't know, but we need to go find out.
We do. Next time I go to Texarkana, I may have to make a trip. So while they were in Texarkana, trying to blow up the gas pipe, they robbed a pawn shop and very graphically murdered the owner, Bill Stump, because they thought he was a Jew. He was not a Jew.
No. Not that that would have justified it, but...
Right. No, of course not.
They were just stupid.
They were. They did not... They was very unsuccessful as to what their plans were. They attempted to murder several other people, right? They had planned a knife attack at a downtown Central Park kind of thing in St. Louis, Kansas City. It's one of the two.
I think it was St. Louis.
See, now I'm thinking it's Kansas City because Metropolitan Community Church is in Kansas City, which is church they tried to blow up.
It was where the church was.
Yep. Metropolitan Community Church at the time was very well known for being pro-homosexual. So they attempted to blow that up, and Kerry, again, was the one who had volunteered to go and blow it up. In the interviews with him and in the book, you know, he talks about he'd gone in with the briefcase, was ready to blow it up, and they were singing the same songs. Yeah.
He was going to leave the briefcase and walk out, and then it would blow up behind him 30 seconds later.
Yeah. He wasn't a suicide bomber. He was just going to plant the bomb and then leave. But a lot of them were singing the same songs that he had heard, and he began to look at them as people, right? Not as demons and evil people.
Okay, so I think that's important, though. Because one of the things we should mention about Kerry Noble is that he has made it his mission now to preach against the evils of this Christian identity stuff. And one of the things that I've learned in life, and I think it's just kind of a concept in life, is it's hard to hate people that you know.
Mm-hmm.
We mentioned earlier about them being out there in the woods kind of off to themselves and not really around other black folks and things.
Right.
When he got there and he was around them folks, he all of a sudden realized he didn't hate them as much as he thought. And this is where his heart starts to change a little bit, according to him. It's really hard to hate people. You know, this is one of the reasons I moved my family to DFW in the first place, is that I wanted my kid to grow up with more diversity. And that's been pretty successful. He has friends. It's funny to me. I feel so backwards sometimes. He has friends that have these names which to me are really difficult to pronounce and say, and I have to, what's their name again? But to him, it's nothing.
Right.
This is his friend so-and-so, and I won't name any of them because they're kids. But this is his friend so-and-so, and his friend so-and-so. And I'm sure he had to learn their names, just like you had to learn Mike, Susie, Larry, and Bob, right?
Right.
But to him, that's nothing, because that's what he's growing up around. And I'm crazy proud of that, because I want my kid to have experiences with other people who don't believe the same way we do, who don't live the same life we do, who come from different cultures and different experiences, because I want him to love those people.
Mm-hmm.
Because my Savior loves those people.
Yep.
Absolutely. Now, this ain't a preaching podcast, but it's hard not to do so sometimes, because Jesus loved those people, I want my kid to learn how to love like that too.
Right.
So he went into this church, and he decided he wasn't able to do it. So he walked out of there and went back a failure.
Right. Yep. They also planned to blow up the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1984.
which was later blown up in 1995.
Yep.
April 19, 1995. A person with ties to Christian Identity.
Right.
And with ties, some people allege, to Ellison.
To Ellison and Elohim City, which is still in Oklahoma today.
Yes.
So, they got violent, right? And I think they had probably already been on the radar of the FBI and the police and whatnot. And April 18th, 1985, the FBI surrounded their compound. Came in the middle of the night, surrounded them. Five of their core military leaders, paramilitary leaders within the group, had gone to town. And so the FBI came in and surrounded them while those guys were out and wouldn't let them come back in to get to their guns. And for 3 days, the FBI blockaded the place, and Kerry Noble served as the negotiator between the FBI and Jim Ellison.
Now, we've left a little bit out in the history here.
We have, because we're already 15 minutes over.
I know, but this is important, so I got to bring it up. And okay. I should have earlier in the point. There was a significant split in their group.
Yes.
At one time. And some people in the group were more extreme, more violent, and they left to go form a group called, it was the Order, right?
Right.
And we may cover them on a different podcast sometime.
Maybe.
Maybe with some other groups like this. They went off and they did their own set of crimes and things. And some of these people who did some of these crimes were part of that group that left, but some of them weren't. And they went off to really commit some crimes around the country.
Yep. Yeah, they split off. And they split off because of a change in ideology. As I think we've talked about with every group so far, you know, there's a core ideology that shows up at the same time, about the time that a group starts to fall apart, and that revolves around some form of sexuality.
Yep.
And this group split off because Jim Ellison decided polygamy was okay.
Yep. He's the leader. He might as well just take on a few extra wives, right?
Yeah, at this point, I think he had already been crowned king of the Ozarks. It got weird. It got real, real weird, people. So
that leads us on to our next part. But do we want to say more about the history here?
I was going to say, let's finish up with FBI raid. They surrounded them. Kerry served as negotiator. And there was not a single shot fired, right? Out of all of those things that I read off earlier, right, that they had in their camp at the time of arrest, no one was shot. No one died. It was just done, right? Ellison went to jail for several years. Kerry Noble went to jail for several years. The guy who murdered the pawn shop owner, Bill Stump, I specifically meant to mention his name because he's a victim in this.
Sure.
You know, that guy's in jail for the rest of his life. It was a big deal, right? After jail time, several people tried to get back together and reform, but it just never happened. So that is the history of the Covenant, the Sword, the Arm of the Lord, from a very 30,000-foot overview. Our blog post may include more, but for now, let's take a break. Yep, so welcome back. We're going to jump into the theology of the CSA and kind of look at some of the things that made it possible for what they did, where they went, where they were going, where they would have wound up had the FBI not shown up. So It seems to be a pretty common occurrence among the cults that we've talked about so far and the ones that I've looked at that we're going to be talking about in the future. Charismaticism is heavily at play here. The Wikipedia page for CSA indicates that they started out as Baptist. They weren't Baptist. I don't think that they were ever Baptist. They put a lot of emphasis on the gifts, specifically prophecy and tongues, from the very beginning. Now, we could dig into the Bible and the texts and whatnot to figure out what parts of this are true and what parts are not, but what the CSA was doing was they were taking anything that was said, right, by Carrie, by Jim, by Jim's wife, whose name I don't remember. Whatever was said by them was the very word of God. And that just leads to a lot more problems than it solves. If it was truly the word of God, it would probably solve a lot of problems, but it caused a whole lot for them.
You mentioned the charismatic thing, and it is true, it's a common thing because whenever you inject in your belief system that emotion gets involved with it and you have a very charismatic leader. Because remember, we're talking about the charismatic thing as a property of a person being charismatic, but also as being open to new revelations, new prophecy type things. And again, I'm trying not to completely critique every little thing because I have my own opinions on it, the way as I understand the Bible about it. But I will say that it's easy to get off track whenever you're able to get off track, right? If you take your car and you drive off the road, after a while it gets easier to drive off the road. And you just keep on going, and you just keep smashing down the curbs, and you just keep on off the top. And so, yeah, that's always the road off, and this was no different here with the CSA at all to do that. And when you worship a person, I think if you had asked them, they wouldn't have said they were worshiping a person.
No.
But they definitely respected and revered a person. And because my spiritual background has been in the Southern Baptist, I was always taught to be a little fearful of worshiping a person too much, a little distrustful of the pastor. Because you know, us Baptists, we'll dismiss the pastor in a quick minute. So even to this day, I have some fear on that. While I say that's what I was taught, but on the other hand, I was also taught pretty much to respect the pastor and to reverence them and things. So you kind of taught both things there. But that's what happened is as things started happening and they started teaching, and again, they're all by themselves up there. More and more, they're becoming a group, and Ellison's the leader of the group. Carey describes himself as being kind of the Bible teacher, the Sunday school teacher, taking that role. And I guess just coming out of Bible school, he would have took that role, right? But Ellison was the leader, and they followed him. And Carey even mentioned about not always completely being in agreement with Ellison. But he's the pastor. I feel the same way with my pastor. I'm not always in agreement with my current pastor. But kind of just, there's a line. Well, at what point do you go different, right? It's not necessarily a bad thing to disagree with your pastor a little bit, but what is this?
We'll get to that one here in a second. I think I know what word you're looking at,
I am.
because it's a new word that we're going to talk about, and I'm going to discuss it in depth.
Is it a new word or an old word?
It's a very, very old word.
There we go.
But it's a new word for you, and it's a new word for Ted and for Adam and for James and everyone else that I've talked to about it the last couple of weeks. But
Rob, that's because you're a nerd, sir.
It is. It's because I'm a very, very big nerd.
You're a theology nerd.
Absolutely. But so I don't know if you noticed, right, as we were talking about the history, some of the things that happened after some sort of prophecy was made, right? Cary Noble only stayed. Yes, he enjoyed the beauty of everything, but Jim just kind of sat up and told him in a service, right? Cary is going to be useful to us, right? And Cary took this in as a prophecy over himself and said, I'm going to be useful here, right? And so he stayed. There was prophecy at the time of the name change, right? From Zarephath to Zarephath Horeb. One thing that they were really, really big on and is still looked at pretty heavily in a lot of charismatic groups is signs and symbology, right? Everything was a sign from God, right? Whether it was positive or negative, it was God's sign that this was supposed to happen, right?
Get you thinking about that all the time.
Exactly. It makes you wonder, you know, what's next, right?
And while you bring that up, so the car wreck we discussed earlier in their history.
Yep, that's what I was just fixing to talk about.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you're good. No, you take it. You're good.
That car wreck, they took that as a sign of, oh, this isn't what God wants us to do.
Right.
So they previously thought this is what they needed to do, but then when that car wreck stopped and they thought, oh, this isn't what God wants us to do. When they were going to the park up there, and we determined it was Kansas City, right?
Yeah.
When they went to the park, they were looking for some gay folks to shoot,
mm-hmm.
to whatever they was going to do to harm.
Yep.
And they didn't find any, even though it was a park known for cruising.
Right.
And so they took that as, well, God doesn't want that to happen. So they took a lot of things they did in life as, well, God wants it this way or that way because it's what happened. Again, one of those dangerous things that lead you,
mm-hmm.
when everything's possible, nothing's impossible. That ain't what I'm trying to say. When everything could be a sign from God, when anything could be a sign from God, everything becomes a sign from God. That's right. What I'm trying to say.
Yep. And, you know, the inverse of that also has to be true, that then nothing is a sign from God, right? Because, you know, same thing as if everyone's special, no one's special. But
I am special.
You know, but so they looked at all these signs and they looked at numbers of things and, you know, how many people came from this group meant something, and how many people came from this group meant something, and their foundation being the same size and square, which it wasn't, it was off by 12 inches, you know, it meant something to them. For their sanctuary that they built, it was not square by 12 inches, which is a lot.
Well, yeah, so, woods, it's hard,
right?
Hard to do that.
So all of these things, right, built up, there was another prophecy at the name change to the CSA, right? Founder of Elohim City, what's his name?
Millar.
Millar, yes. Millar came, and or they went there, one way or the other, and Millar prophesied over Ellison, naming him the King of the Ozarks, right? And it was at that point that things really got weird with James Ellison. And there's just so many more examples throughout Cary's book of times that they relied on prophecy or tongues or whatever the case may be to make a decision. And that leads to the next word, right? The key word of all of this, right? The theological problem with this is the word prelest. P-R-E-L-E-S-T. Prelest. There is a super duper long article on a wiki page that I will link to that goes into what prelest is, but prelest is, let me read St. Ignatius, a man's assimilation of falsehood as truth. these prophecies, right, that were coming, there may have been times, right? I'm not going to say that someone was not used by God to say something that was positive and good and would have put them in the right direction had they followed it. But those things that were spoken that were clearly in opposition to the love of God, right? Those things that are hate, right? Were not prophecies from God. Therefore, they must be prophecies from Satan, right? And these people at CSA took these ideas and said, because it's prophecy coming to me from the spiritual world, it must be God, so therefore it's truth, right? They fell into pre-lest, and they fell there hard.
See, I was always taught that if you were going to have prophecy, it had to be backed up by the Word of God, and that it had to be backed up by the Word of God. If you're going to have prophecy, and that if someone were to prophesy and it disagreed with the Word of God, then there was a problem.
Yep.
So that's what I was always taught about the prophecy part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we see many examples through history where that's become a problem, where people got off because mm-hmm. they just said whatever they wanted. They had no what is truth, no foundation for yep. their belief, because they could change it by prophecy, right?
Mm-hmm.
That gets you so far off there.
It does. It makes the speaker into God.
Yes.
Yeah. So this idea of prelest, right, followed them from Ebah, right? Ebah taught them something that was not truth, right? And they took it in as truth. And from there, it just, everything kept coming and piling on top of it. Now, you know, I'm going to say we all suffer from prelest at some point or another, right? We all fall into it. We all take something that's not true and believe and act and live as if it is, right? Every single one of us has some form of prelest in our lives right now. But the difference is, for those of us that are actively seeking the truth, that are actively searching the Word, searching the Bible, searching through the church, searching however to find God, right? We're trying to get out of prelest.
Well, and again, I keep struggling that this is not a preaching podcast per se, but look, this right here is a good example of why it's important for you to know the Word of God, to always be able to call to account, right? Because it is easy to get led astray, and I see this happen so often with new believers. They get so excited because they begin this relationship with Jesus, and until you have a relationship, you don't understand how exciting that can truly be. And then they just, it's like they're like spiritual babies, right? We talk about the milk and the meat, and the example. They're just looking for something, and they listen to every old preacher they can. And sometimes they get off on these bad tangents. Look, I myself have listened to some preachers over the years and believed some things that later I realized weren't true.
Yep.
And I'm like, why did I listen to this? I didn't know any better, you know?
Right.
And that's what was happening to these folks. They got off. I think that on a certain hand, because they had such extremist beliefs, which offend me so much about the racism thing, that I want to say they're just horrible people and just psh. But on the other hand, I want to say I see how people can get off that. You know, we talked before about covering a group that we thought we could be part of, and then once we started discovering that we could have gotten deceived by, like they did, not be a part of per se. But then once we started studying on them, we were like, wait, we would have gotten this deceived, you know? But I still see some things where I know people like this, and I know people who could have went down this path. And look, as we start thinking one person is the prophecy for things, that's how we start believing that, you know, our magical person was the one who should be president. Our magical person is the one who You know, even though all logic dictates they are not a good person and not a follower of Christ, they're the God's chosen one, right? It's how we get off on these things,
right? Yeah, I was debating in myself whether or not we were going to talk about this, because it goes back to a point in time for me that I very strongly regret, right? And I wrote down the time that I started talking in case we decided to edit this. but I very easily could have fallen into this. Very easily. And I can say that because I kind of did. Not necessarily as far down the path that Cary Noble and the rest of the CSA went, but that far, far right wing political position, right? Shortly after college, this is just gonna be a long episode, Matt.
right.
We're gonna have to pay Ted a lot. But in college, you know, I think I've told you, I was in a car accident and my best friend was killed. Did I tell you that?
Maybe your best friend was killed.
Okay, so we've talked about that, you know, and when she died, you know, I fell into that looking for signs, right? I started looking for what was next, because every person that I talked to, by every single account, I should not be sitting here talking to you, right? And every person, the pastor of the church, the youth pastor of my friends' churches, right? Every single one of them that I talked to was like, God's got a purpose for your life. You're here for a reason. You need to start looking for what God's going to do for you, right? And so I did. I sat down and I started looking, and I started wondering and started exploring the vastness of Christianity, right? And that summer is when, at the time, I felt called to the ministry, right? As a good Baptist college student does. And, you know, became a licensed minister and all that fun stuff. But while I was at the camp, I made some friends, and we started talking about solutions to the coming problems, right? Because the Baptist church that I grew up in, right, really, really dealt, when I was there, dealt in a lot of fear, right? Just like these guys.
Yeah, right? they were more exclusionary. Exclusionists are the word, but they are well known to be we're the only ones.
Right.
I'm not saying that's what you believe. I'm just saying I know that right. group is known to be we're the ones, we're the chosen. Yep.
So they, you know, they dealt in a lot of fear. You know, Jesus is coming back, blah, 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 blah. And I remember telling Ted just a couple of weeks ago, I was like, you know, looking at some of the stuff that the CSA was teaching and the survivalism, the paramilitary, not quite the right white supremacy, but all of these things are things that I was kind of being taught, right? Not overtly, right? Not in the sense that we would have a sermon about, you know, Jesus is coming back this summer and so judgments are going to come and blah, 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 blah. It was more, God is going to judge this nation at some point, right? And so we have to be ready, right? We need to know that when God's judgment comes, that people are going to suffer. There was no timelines or no anything like that attached to it, but it was a lot of that fear. and I got together with this group of friends, and they had gone through kind of the same things, and so we started to talk amongst ourselves, and we worked for a while and built up a small little group of people that felt the same way and did all the normal things that you would do and planned for survival, right?
Yeah. Bloodletting.
Yeah, so of course, you know, no big deal.
Those sort of things.
But, right, and about the time that I realized the direction that this was going was when we partnered with other groups that felt the same way. So much so that I wrote the constitution for all of these groups, right? For them to come together as a single entity and serve as one body of individual groups. I wrote their documents, right? I had several other pretty well-known right-wing groups calling me and talking about things to be done internet-wise, right? Because it's me, and apparently tech is my thing. you know, talking about how do we do X, Y, and Z with the internet? How do we connect here and make this work? And those kind of questions. So, you know, when I say I could see myself living in Mountain Home with these guys, up to that white supremacist moment, absolutely. Absolutely. And
you
that's...
make fun of me because I say I could be a Mennonite.
Right? Now, Amish, I could do Amish. I could go full on no tech. I'd love it. But, except for their beliefs. They got some weird... Anyway, that's a different podcast. Or maybe not. But,
right.
So I fell into that, right? Seeing the signs of God everywhere, falling into the profiteering prophecy pundits that are out there that are just out for money.
That sounds like a Baptist sermon right there. You had your three P's.
Right?
Give me two scripture and a benediction. We'll be all right.
Yep. So yeah, I mean, I think, and really, you know, I know a lot of your history, and I think taught the right things at the right time, you and I would be in the same boat.
Yeah, when I became a Christian, I did not realize how conservative of a church I joined, or mm-hmm. what the differences were, and I ate everything up. Like, I just yep. took, as gospel, everything I was taught. And it wasn't until later that I've learned that some of those things weren't. Some of them quite recently. You know, this is still an ongoing process. I always joke that I'm a recovering Baptist, you know. but not just a Baptist. You know, we talk about Baptists because we both come from backgrounds in that. But even we've got variations, and there's a lot of variation there. But, yeah, I really ate it up because I was honestly trying to follow the Lord. And we were so right. charismatic, too. My very first time after I told you, I joined that church, they're like, well, there's a men's meeting on Tuesday. This was Sunday. So I went to the men's meeting. We loaded up in the back of a church van, drove around to old people's homes and anointed them with oil and laid hands on them and prayed for them.
Mm-hmm.
That's not very Baptist things to do, apparently. But I didn't know. I just know that this is what the pastor said we did. So we went out and did it, you know.
That's what you did. Yep.
So yeah, I could see getting off. I would like to say I wouldn't get into as hateful of stuff as they did. And I will say that if you look at interviews modern day, because culture no longer tolerates
right.
The derogatory terms and things for racism. Not that racism is dead. Racism is still alive and well. Our culture still has issues with systemic racism, etc. I'm not trying to talk that down. We're not post-racism
right.
yeah. yet. We are better as a country than we were before, but we have a lot of work to go. All that preface to say, if you look at interviews and things with people in this Christian identity movement, including that Millar guy, they no longer use the terminology of hate. Matter of fact, they don't even call themselves racist. They call themselves racialist because they're trying to redefine it and say they just prefer to preserve the Aryan race or the white race or whatever. And that they fear that it would disappear because of mixing of the races and stuff.
Right.
Versus I'm on the opposite thing. I'm doing everything I can to let's mix them up, baby. You know?
So, okay, so you're bringing us to their other theological problem, right? And that's Christian identity. The Christian identity movement is a... I cannot say that it's a heresy, right? Matt can say that it's a heresy.
Why is
because
that?
Because we have different definitions of the word heresy. Because okay. Heresy, to be a heresy from my point of view, you have to have chosen to leave the Orthodox Church, right?
But most people don't know the Orthodox Church exists.
Exactly, right. So the proper definition of heresy is one that has left the church. These guys... I don't think we're ever really, those that are Christian identity, I don't think Christian identity was ever really a part of the church. I think it's a side piece that has pulled out pieces of Christian theology and applied them to themselves.
Like so many things, right?
Like so many things. They would be considered heterodox, right? They are alongside, but they are not orthodox, right? Orthodox big O or orthodox little O, right? However we want to describe that. But they are absolutely wrong.
Yeah, I have no problem saying they're wrong. And not just because right. Racism is now a cultural no-no, versus back then it wasn't as much so.
Right.
But because they just absolutely are. There's no biblical evidence for what they're trying to say as much as they try yep. to act like there is. It's not even questionable, honestly.
Right. Now, our listeners can't see this, right? But Matt can see. Right, I have journal articles.
Big furry stuffed animal.
Big thick stack of journal articles that I've read through on Christian identity. It's probably 100 pages, right? And it's all about how wrong that it is, right? And it's everything from this leads to terrorism, right? In the proper definition, not the we're just talking about Islam as terrorists, like actual real life this is what terrorism is, to something, what was the next one, religious terrorism, psychosocial determinants. I mean, it's just, it's everything from, you know, just, it's awful. Right, I don't even think that I could sit here and go through everything in these documents, right, if we had a six-hour podcast, right? There's just so many pieces of it, and so much of it stems from a misreading of the very, very beginning of the Bible. If you get that wrong, everything that comes after it is wrong.
Well, now let's talk about that, because talk about Genesis. Genesis is kind of hard because Genesis is an old book, right?
Yep.
And Genesis seems to repeat itself.
It does.
In the very beginning. Do we want to discuss the verse that they start with?
Genesis 3:15?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have it brought up? I don't have my phone in front of me, and I've just reloaded my computer.
I can bring it up.
Okay.
I find it interesting that you return to your phone first.
Well, the only other Bible that I have here is a Ryrie New American Standard, and I don't want to use the Masoretic text. Because I'm a nerd.
Wow, you just be fancy like that, huh?
Mm-hmm.
We automatically think, oh, I should read something from the Bible. We read it from our phone. You could pull it up on your computer. You could pull it up. I bet you have another Bible back there somewhere. I do. I have several behind me, but I thought of the same thing. Hey, pull it up on my phone.
Right.
So Genesis 3:15.
Okay.
I'm going to read from the English Standard Version. We can discuss why later. It says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel.
Okay.
They're using that verse to say that Eve had a child with Satan.
Yep.
Or the serpent, in this case.
The history of the Illuminati, as written by Carrie Noble in the pamphlet called The Witchcraft and the Illuminati, reads this way. He says, How then did Eve partake of his fruit? Right, going back to Genesis 3:13. Genesis 3:13 says that Nakash, right, which is the Hebrew word for the serpent here, beguiled Eve. This word beguiled literally means to seduce. Fruit also literally means seed or offspring. If indeed Eve was physically seduced by the Negro Nakash, then how does this fit in? So we have to go back again, right? Where did he get this idea that the Nakash was black? Let me go back. Nakash, which means to enchant. The Nakash was a beast of the field. A careful study of this term will reveal who this living creature is, the Negro race, created prior to Adam, who is the beginning of the white race.
But again, none of this is in the Bible.
This is page one of his book.
Right, but this is not what's actually in the Bible.
No, not at all. So there.
If you can just write what you want, then you can come up with any story you want.
Yep. Now, what we can. How deep do we want to go down this rabbit hole, Matt? I'm giving you the choice.
What do you mean?
I mean, I can go back here and get my interlinear Bible and we can actually look up these words.
No, I don't think our listeners.
No, okay. Okay, I'm just giving you the chance. But, yeah, it's so... They took this idea that had been planted in their head, right, by someone else who had had this idea planted in his head by someone else or by the devil himself, right? And they ran with it. And they took it so far, right, that now the offspring of Eve in Genesis 3:15 is no longer part of the proto-evangelium, right? It's not about Jesus, but it's about Abel, right? It's no longer that. It's about two human boys, right, that Eve gave birth to, one of whom was the son of Satan, and the other the son of Adam, right?
And let's talk about how that's just not how human bodies work.
What do you mean?
Aren't they? You don't just get pregnant with one baby, then pregnant with another baby, and then have both babies. That's what they're trying to say, right?
Well, according to his book, there is some historical precedent that it's a medical fact that it can happen. I don't think I've ever heard of it happening, but. Were Cain and Abel twins?
I don't know for sure.
I mean, I don't... my keyboard's too loud. I don't think I was ever taught that Cain and Abel were twins.
I don't know that I was either. But I thought that's what they were implying, that they were twins. They were born at once.
Right. Yeah, that's what they're implying.
Fathers.
But... Yeah, no, in chapter 4, it's two verses. Now the man laid with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I've gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So, just based on the English reading, you might could make a case that they were twins. But it does not explicitly say that.
Okay. Either way, they're still wrong whether that part's wrong or not.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, the rest of it, I mean, the rest of it's wrong. So, yeah. But, so it, they've taken this idea and they've applied the non-white races to Cain, right? Who was cursed, sent out, the ground would no longer produce for him. So he went and started civilization, right? Went and built a city because he had nothing else to do. And so they're basically just saying that he went off and that's where all the other races came from, because Adam and Seth subsequently were white and only white.
And then we go to the other part.
Because if y'all could see Matt, he's just kind of sitting back. He's like, I don't, this is just crazy.
By introvert, extrovert, switch flips. I'm trying here.
Yeah.
Then we go to the other part where that's part of it, right? This.
Right.
And then what you wrote here, secondary STEM, about the 10 lost tribes. So let's talk about these 10 lost tribes. So there were 12 tribes of Israel.
Right.
They were the 12 sons of Israel.
Yep.
At one point, the kingdom was split in half. And the kingdom was overrun.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 of the tribes of Israel kind of been cut off. We don't really know what happened. They were absorbed into the Assyrians.
The Assyrians are the ones who came and sacked Israel, carted them off, and that was the end. That was them. They either assimilated completely with the Assyrians, or when they left, they continued further north.
They were cut off as slaves, basically.
Right.
Their cities were ransacked for whatever resources they had, their livestock, etc. And remember, while they lived in the Promised Land, there were some good things about their land, but there was also a lot of bad about their land. There's a whole lot of ancient and modern Israel that isn't very habitable land.
Right, yeah. It's a whole bunch of desert.
Yeah. They wandered in that desert for 40 years at one point, right?
Yep.
But then two tribes that kind of continued on. But those 10 tribes. So they're saying those 10 tribes went off into Europe and became Europe. They kind of just ignore, you know, who might have been in Europe instead at that time. Kind of ignore any history before that.
Yep.
Maybe they are Baptists. They just take chunks of history and just act like it didn't happen.
That's supposed to be for me to say, not for you.
Oh, sorry. I learned that during the seminary, honestly. But, right. Yeah. So that's their other thing, is that the Jewish people who are known to have a covenant with God because of just being descended from Abraham, they claim the Jewish people are not who the Jewish people are nowadays. The people who say they are Jews now are not actually the Jewish people. But right. That was stolen somehow, and thus they hate Jews because of it. Don't quite totally understand that. They say the Jewish people are in control of the government and the banking system, and etc. And look, there is some, I don't want to say there's some truth, because that ain't accurate. There is some data points you could look at and see that there is a percentage, I don't even know if it's a large percentage, a percentage of people with Jewish names who control the banking system and things like that. Some Christians would argue that's part of the covenant and the blessing from Abraham. Some would argue mm-hmm. it's just some people have names like that. It's not really, right. Causation is not correlation, or what have you, you know? But they did that, but this is the other part of their belief there, so that they see that these people are assuming a covenant that isn't there, so they hate them for it, kind of. and they think they're an enemy. And as you kind of build up an enemy, and again, if you don't know these people, it's easy to turn them into your enemy. You can just kind of invent all kinds of things. It's not like they just sit around one day and say, let's invent some stuff, but they let the fear get to them.
Right.
Until it gets worse and worse. You know, Hitler used the Jews as a scapegoat because there was a Jewish population there, and he said, these are the source of your problems.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the only one to do that. He wasn't an original thought. This has been happening. And again, some people say this is because of the Jewish people's covenant with the Lord and their dedication or lack thereof. They've been persecuted. It was prophesied that they would be persecuted like this. It doesn't justify the persecution, but it just explains why that may have happened in history over time. Some people say that. I don't know about all that, but I do know that the Christian Identity Movement decided that the Jewish people are not the Jewish people, so they hate those people.
Right.
And that's not what Jesus preached.
It's interesting, you know, because we know, right, from Carey's writings and other Christian identity writings, like all of these journals that we've been reading through, right, that they believe to be descended from the 10 tribes, right? But this book that Carey Noble wrote on this Christian identity goes from Nimrod, right, which if you'll remember, Nimrod is Genesis chapter like 11, 12, right, to Constantine in 312 AD. It just skips all of that history. Doesn't describe it at all.
Okay.
So, yeah, so he doesn't explain why or anything like that, why they think that they're the 10 tribes, or why, how Jesus could be of the tribe of Judah but not be of one of the tribes that's Satan, that's whatever. they don't try to explain all of that, at least not in Carey's pamphlet.
Well, and let's also talk about one of those cultural things. So, at that time, if you were to go into a church or to any sort of religious thing or open up your family Bible and you've seen a picture of Jesus, you're going to see this lily white, blue-eyed, European-looking man.
Mm-hmm.
Which we know is probably not what Jesus looked like. We don't know what Jesus looked like, but based on the way the people look that are over there, from where Jesus would have been from, he probably didn't look like that.
Got a pretty good idea what he looked like. But you're right. You know, he definitely didn't. And I was at a church yesterday and went downstairs to do something, and they had a painting of Jesus and Mary and Joseph, and they were super duper pale white, and I was just like, this is not right.
Yeah, well, at least the cardboard Pope didn't stare at you up down the hallway.
That's true too. So, you know, the whole thing with Christian identity, white supremacy, even the Christian survivalism, right? It's focused around hate and fear instead of love and hope, which is what true Christianity is supposed to be focused around. And they just completely ignore that.
Yep.
So, Matt, let's take one more quick break, and then we'll jump into the last couple of things on the social structure of the CSA. All right, Matt, so you've got us some thoughts on the social structure and things that were going on within CSA that potentially makes them a cult. What do you get?
Well, social structure wise, obviously they were led by their leader, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Carey has mentioned several times about him being, you know, kind of the Bible study guy and the propaganda guy and that sort of stuff. But also, you know, we mentioned earlier about their conversion into polygamy. They did not. They were led by the men of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing by itself, but that is part of that progression down, like we mentioned earlier.
Now, hang on. We have to be very clear here, right? Because you used a pronoun without really defining which referent you're talking to. We're not saying polygamy is not a bad thing.
No, that wasn't what I meant at all.
He's talking about being led by the group of guys is not necessarily the bad thing.
Y'all, Ryan's my friend. He's trying to make sure I don't get cut tonight if my wife hears this podcast. What do you mean polygamy is a good thing?
We'll just make sure that's clear.
I have one wife, and she is wonderful enough. I have no more room in my heart for anybody else.
Amen.
Hopefully I covered myself there, darling. So, no, I was not saying polygamy is a good thing. What I'm saying is being led by the men of the group is not by itself such a bad thing, but it can often lead to a bad end whenever you say this group is lesser than this group.
Right.
So, there was an interview that Cary Noble did right after the whole FBI bust, and he said something in there about basically they believed that there wasn't enough real men in this country, and so for the women that there were, so basically men had to take on more than one wife because there wasn't enough, and it wasn't for the women to take on more than one partner, but more than one spouse, but it would be for the men.
Right.
This is a bunch of blue ball. But social structure wise, honestly, you know, they wanted in the beginning to be a part of something. And I think overall they were still trying to look for acceptance. When they had the COVID-cation thing and all that, they were looking for acceptance with other groups to be a part of something, which is an innate human need here. So as isolationists as they were, they actually worked with and talked with and communicated with other groups quite a bit.
Yeah.
It's like watching YouTube videos about things. You spiral down. Which, by the way, if you're going to look up cult stuff on YouTube, you should not do it logged into your channel. You should do it on a whole different account.
Use a private window. Don't track yourself.
Yeah. Don't use DuckDuckGo, though. I'd recommend Brave. But then they got further and further, and they were trying to please by being extremist. Cary had mentioned about he was trying to do these things, and then you know, they were going to go assassinate people, and then the car wreck, and they were going to go to the park, and then all this, and the blowing up the church. And that he was a failure. And he mentioned that things were falling apart before the raid happened. He no longer fully believed everything. But he also was too tied into it to walk away.
Yeah. In that same note, you know, one of the things that he talks about at the very, like in the epilogue of his book, is how he realized, you know, like you said, he realized he had gotten to that point and he needed to go. But every time that he would get ready to, something would happen, right? And he would start to think, well, maybe God has me here to do this, to make this group better, to fix this problem, to be the middleman, to do this. He continued down that path of spiritual delusion. Right? God is speaking to me and telling me to do something. 2-3 years before the end, right? He started to feel that and kept saying, well, maybe I can fix this. Maybe when Jim is gone, I can fix this. You can't do that.
You know, I think this is probably one of those things where you and I don't 100% agree on God's revelation to people. I want to interject here that I don't think that the Lord never speaks to anybody.
Right.
Or that book is closed somehow and we're past the apostolic times and there's none of that happening. But obviously they got off and they were listening to the wrong things. And you can't assume that every little notion is that God spoke, or every little thing that happens because God spoke.
Right.
There's definitely a line to be had there, and they crossed it, and so it got worse. That's really all I have about the social structure, because we've talked so much about it through the rest of the things. Yep, before we bring up our final question about this group, is there anything else you'd like to add or contribute there?
Well, on the social side, you know, we've talked about so much of it. They were led by a charismatic leader who
Are you really going to put his picture on the block?
Yes, if I can find one, or maybe it might be a picture of their logo. I don't know yet.
I've got a picture if you'd like.
Okay.
It's probably the source you don't have.
Right, I know I used Jim Jones's picture because it was just a good picture of the situation. But Ellison had that charismatic nature that is really a core point of a group that starts to fall away, right? And then he isolated them, right? He gave them a reason, right? Whether that reason was hope or fear, either way, it was a reason to isolate themselves. In their case, it was fear, but and then he or Carrie, right, controlled any and all knowledge that came into that place, right? They ensured that it matched up with what they wanted the people to know. Anything that wasn't part of that, it just didn't get shared. And that's a big deal, right? If you're in a situation, if you're in that kind of situation and you're getting to listen to this podcast, good for you. If you know someone who falls into this situation, share this podcast with them. Because if they're not being able to hear anything except for what the quote unquote teacher is telling them, there's probably a problem. There's something deep down there that needs to be evaluated.
Yeah, that's often a thing you see is that tune out the devil. You know, turn off that other stuff. Don't get me wrong. You know, we've talked before about being fathers and being careful what our kids are exposed to. But there's that whole sheltering thing too. You don't want to shelter them too much because you want them to be able to make. I want my son to make the decision to follow the Lord, but I want him to make that decision. I can't make it for him, and I don't want to push it on him so much that he doesn't have a genuine, heartfelt desire to do so, you know. And when you in a group like this, we've talked about this in all of our episodes so far about being where you only have the one source of information. So I think that leads us to our question about, you know, is this a cult? And I think that's one of our qualifying things. You know, we started this whole podcast talking about what is a cult. It's a thing that's somewhat hard to define, yet it's one of those things that when you know it, you know it when you see it. And I don't think this is a hard argument.
Okay, go ahead and finish your sentence.
Oh,
Sorry.
go ahead.
I think it's a lot harder than you're thinking.
I think we want it to be a lot harder because we don't want things that maybe we don't consider to be cults to be possibly classified as a cult.
Maybe.
You know,
But
I'm talking about myself here, but
right.
I'm sure I hit a straight with you too, you know. We could say this is a misguided religious movement. But the difference becomes whenever things get destructive and when it comes focused on one leader like that, or sometimes it's a small group of leaders, but even in the small group of leaders, it always comes down to one. So although Kerry says he was the number two, he was the number two. The truth was he had to negotiate between the government and Ellison. At the end of the day, whenever they surrendered to the police, to the FBI, it was Ellison who had to agree to the surrender.
Yeah.
He was the leader of the place.
I'm looking back at our blog post from episode one, looking at the questions that we put forth to answer.
It's a good thing to do.
The theological questions is, does this group claim a larger faith as their core? Yes, they claimed Christianity. Do the teachings of the group go against the core teachings of that faith? Yes, clearly. Are there added teachings to the core? Yes. Again, theologically, they hit all three, right? Is the group's existence centered around a single person or family? This one, I would say, maybe.
This group, yes. Christian identity itself, not necessarily. Because, see, we're asking this to CSA a cult, not as Christian identity a cult.
Right, right. But I'm saying I don't think they were necessarily centered around Ellison. They might have been in the very, very beginning, right? But I think they shifted, and they became centered around the single ideology of Christian identity, right? Whether it was Ellison or not that was leading them, they would have stayed centered around Christian identity.
So that's an interesting question. It is one that I wish we'd had the opportunity to ask Cary Noble about.
Right.
Again, because he's got that perspective that he's the guy that was there.
Yeah.
Right.
Maybe we'll get to do a follow-up one day.
Well, and this is where we should mention that Cary Noble is still around.
Yep.
He's written a second book.
Pretty sure he lives here in Dallas, doesn't he?
Yes. I don't know where, and if I did, I wouldn't disclose it. But, yes, he apparently lives in the DFW area. He actively does interviews and things. We didn't contact him for one, partially because we're not that big and we don't have any budget to hire people for stuff.
Right.
I don't even know if he charges, but we don't have the budget for that. But I know that he is still actively, I don't use the word preaching, speaking.
Yeah.
Somewhat preaching against the whole Christian identity thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the hatred. And from what I understand, go ahead.
I was going to say, which is what brings me back to, I think that's where they ended, right? They ended centered around that. And Ellison was just the one kind of leading them that direction. Whereas like Jim Jones, everything was centered around Jones and his personality, right?
Tony Alamo,
everything was centered around him and his personality.
Did the book say what happened to the other people? You mentioned something about trying to do a revival of the group.
Yeah, they all got together. They got together in, oh dear, I'm looking.
Because several people went to jail.
Several people went to jail.
But I don't think like the women and children and stuff went to jail.
No, most of the women didn't. Obviously none of the kids did. I say obviously. In the 70s it would have been obvious that none of the kids went to jail.
I will tell you, if you go on YouTube, you will see that you'll see comments from some people claiming to be some of the kids and some of the people who lived out there.
Yeah, I will make sure that I get it in the podcast or the blog about events about their revival or whatever, because I can't find it in the book offhand. So
we mentioned
the next
about
question.
Ellison. Before we go to the next question, Ellison ended up at the Elohim City.
Uh-huh.
With other Christian identity people. So he never did reject this.
Right, yeah, he still falls into that category. Along with Millar's son.
Well, he did. He's no longer alive.
No, his Millar's son. Millar himself is dead, but the son is still
living. Ellison is dead.
No, not unless he died just recently.
Yes. He did.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, Cary Noble put it on Facebook.
Ah.
He passed away.
That would be why I probably hadn't seen it, because I don't get on Facebook and look at
stuff. That's where the picture is. He posted a picture of him, too. It could be very surprising.
Oh, cool. Yeah, you're right. That's a source that I don't have. So, okay, how is the group perceived is our next question. And I think they're perceived as extremists, but I don't know that people necessarily perceive them as a cult as much as right-wing terrorists.
Right. That's the thing. They see them as terrorists. And honestly, they were not as well-known. They made the news in a little bit when they got busted and for some of the things, but they weren't as well-known until after the Oklahoma City bombing.
Right.
Which was a much bigger terrorist act because they were grouped with them because it was known that they had planned to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Since it was known they had planned to do that, the police obviously looked their direction, even though they had been busted and everything 10 years earlier.
Yep. And then the final question, has the group removed themselves from society? And yes, they most certainly did. So I would say they hit at least five of these. Or, well, I guess four. One of them's leaning pretty heavily one direction. So I think we could probably say they are pretty much a cult. They may not hit every single target that tells you that someone's a cult, but they're definitely up there.
I agree. I was thinking about something about that definition, but we'll discuss that later in the next episode. Yeah. I think we may be time to update our definition.
Excellent. That might be a good next episode is just revisiting our definitions.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anything else we want to say on the covenant of the sword and the arm of the Lord?
No, sir. I think we have covered a lot of ground.
I am disappointed they have a cool name and they're so sucky.
Yeah, well, we'll have to come up with a nice new name for our cult.
There you go. All right, folks. Well, next time we will come to you with a new faith fraud or
falsehood.
Are they falsehoods?
We'll find out.